Sometimes people ask me why I sit here night after night in the gloom of a Chthonian studio. That's a very good word, Chthonian. Look it up sometime. And it's because, like most Australian creatures, like most Australian animals, I come out at night. And I think night's really terrific and daylight is wildly overrated. Nonetheless, I'm fascinated for the opportunity to discuss light with my next guest. I concede the right lighting can create the perfect ambience in a room, a home, a street, and perhaps an entire city. And my guest, Mark Major, specialises in the interplay between light and architecture. He's a senior partner with the international lighting practice Spears Major in London. He's lit all sorts of structures. The doomed Millennium Dome comes to mind, Beijing International Airport. He's even done a lighting job in Westminster Abbey, and he's also helped light up cities, authored a lighting strategy for the City of London. And I am almost alarmed to say that he has a master plan for our very own Barangaroo in Sydney. Mark joins us to tell us all about light, and I hope will express some sympathy for darkness. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Would you be kind enough to tell me exactly what a lighting architect is?
Yes, it's probably an unusual title that people won't have heard many times before. But to put it in a nutshell, I originally trained and qualified as an architect before I was going to say falling into lighting design. And it's sort of these things are sort of never quite as predicted. And I literally sort of work with light as an extension of my original role as an architect. And these days, in fact, for the last 35 years, I spent all of my professional time designing, working with other architects and artists and interior designers and landscape designers, creating the lighting for their schemes.
I have to ask you, because I mentioned it in introducing you, what did you do in Westminster Abbey? I would have thought that God did the lighting there, allowing it to filter through stained glass.
Absolutely, but it does get dark, particularly in the winter's afternoons. And so working in a building like Westminster Abbey is an incredible challenge, because such buildings, particularly the interiors, were never really designed to be sort of seen in artificial light or the artificial light of today's world. And so therefore we have to sort of fulfill all sorts of needs. You know, there's the basic requirements for supporting worship, using light to sort of create the right atmosphere and ambience, but also the sort of put light where it's needed by the celebrants. We also sort of need to think about sort of how we reveal the architecture, so you can see it after dark, but not over reveal it, sort of take away its sense of mystery.
I suddenly remember reading in a biography of Renoir, the painter, by his son, the film director, that Renoir detested tallow candles and could only tolerate the softer glow of beeswax. In a sense, these are considerations, these sorts of things must be considerations for you.
Absolutely, trying to create that soft light, that sort of, and in somewhere like Westminster Abbey, an upward light that sort of emulates candlelight but doesn't try and sort of fake it, is a real challenge. You know, the lighting has to feel appropriate to the space that it's in, and certainly not. And yes, it can, you know, allow new interpretations and new ways of seeing things. So it's an interesting challenge.
When does the modern incarnation of lighting architecture begin?
My view is it really was something that came to prominence or came to the fore in the early part of the 20th century. There's always a sort of a bit of a question mark as to who whether it was the Americans or the Germans that led the way. But generally speaking, the feeling is that the expressionist architects, particularly in Germany in the sort of early part of the 20th century, round about sort of 1914 leading to 1920, were the first to really grab artificial light or electric light, this sort of what was a relatively new medium at that time, really embrace it and try and integrate it into architecture rather than just sort of apply it.
Mark, you make the point that in the past, the only way you could get artificial light was to burn something, and all of them had naked flames or shielded flames and wasn't very flexible.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sort of pretty much up to the time that Edison, or I guess being an Englishman, I might say Swan, gave his electric, the benefit of electric light. Yes, you had to burn something, and not only was it sort of were you in danger of setting fire to the building, but even if you could do that relatively safely, how you could position light and the products of combustion that came off whatever it was you were burning, whether it was beeswax or paraffin or, you know, even gas in the early days of industrialization, gave you potential technical issues that meant you couldn't do as much with artificial light as you obviously can now.
You make the point that early American architects like the sainted Frank Lloyd Wright in his prairie houses and some of his later work was absolutely brilliant in weaving electric light into his buildings.
Yes, Frank Lloyd Wright really sort of grabbed electric light in the most incredible way, though he, rather ubiquitously, he tended to sort of use spheres as a sort of repeating motif in a lot of his early buildings. But he created all sorts of amazing innovations, such as, you know, creating different sort of lighting moods. I remember visiting the Robey House years ago and being amazed to find that there were switches on the wall called sun, moon and stars, and you could sort of mix the lighting and sort of create real atmosphere.
Well, he actually was thinking of mood lighting and wired the house to achieve it.
Yeah, absolutely. From what I experienced there, that was the case.
So were American architects cutting edge?
I think it's interesting to sort of that in looking at the way in which American architects reacted to artificial lighting. I think it was a lot, particularly on the sort of exterior lighting on the big scale with the evolving towers of, say, the New York or the Chicago skylines. Lighting was a lot more applied, a little bit more cosmetic, and the European architects, I felt, sort of produced more integrated schemes, perhaps sort of slightly more imaginative and certainly more architectural, if I can use that term.
So you talk about a long prehistory for what we call mood lighting, but say that after the Second World War, we lost the plot, that lighting became what, more bleak and mechanical?
Yes, I think it's only a matter of my own perception, but I think lighting sort of became seen as a much more technical subject rather than, you know, it always has been an art as well as a science, whether that's in the field of architecture or film or in theatre. It is an art as well as a science, but I think we lost the art of lighting design, and it became very much more about lighting engineering, about efficiency, about sort of delivering certain, you know, a certain amount of light in a certain place, preoccupation with sort of calculations and a much more technical approach. And I think architects became sort of, you know, almost sort of surrendered their understanding of the way in which artificial light would be used, you know, very much to the engineering professions after the war.
Mark, decades ago I spent many years making films, and of course they were once defined as painting with light. And I suddenly realised that one of the venues in the world that really did go for quite clever lighting were the grand old cinemas. I remember in Melbourne there was a giant cinema called The State, and you'd go in there and the whole place had incredible sort of lighting, including the illusion of a star-studded ceiling. So Hollywood must have been very sympathetic to your profession.
Yes, I mean, there are fantastic examples, particularly coming out of the Art Deco period and sort of, you know, as the Expressionist period, where, you know, there really were some remarkable lighting schemes around. And I really wish that colour photography had been sort of better around that period, because often we see the results of these in black and white photographs, but forget that actually quite a lot of these lighting schemes inside buildings, particularly cinemas and theatres, were highly coloured.
Mark, where are we at today?
Well, today we've undergone and are still undergoing quite a revolution in technology. I mean, everybody is familiar with the good old LED. We know it saves energy produces a lot of light very efficiently. But I feel where we are is that we're reaching sort of quite a challenging point, particularly in the sort of the external realm, where it doesn't seem to me that, I mean, you mentioned darkness in the introduction, and it doesn't seem to me that we are using less light as a result of things having become more energy efficient. We seem to be using more light than ever. And I totally echo and sympathize with your statement about sort of darkness being not only a value, but an incredibly important thing to all of us.
Well, here we do find common ground. So let's have a look at it. Yes, I am a nocturnal creature. You're talking to a lot of people on a nocturnal medium. But darkness tends to be culturally, always, has been feared.
Yes, very much so. And I think that's a great shame. I think we're sort of brought up to fear the dark. You know, it's deep within our psyches and within our subconscious. And very much light has always been sort of sold to us, particularly artificial light, as, you know, brightest is best, and, you know, let's sort of extend the day into the night, and all of these different paradigms that have existed that sort of try and persuade us that somehow darkness is a bad thing. But it's not a bad thing. It's a natural condition, it's something, you know, the qualities of the night can be very, very beautiful. And of course, you know, there are places where all of us in cities particularly don't necessarily sort of want to venture, you know, in the darkness if we're not sure about where we are. But generally speaking, I think it's a lot safer out there after dark than people perhaps may imagine.
A great Australian historian, Geoffrey Blainey, came on the program, must have been 10 years ago, talking about the function of moonlight in this country. Everything was done by moonlight in the rural sector. It was the only time you could make hay. It was the only time you could visit neighbours, because you could, in moonlight, you could find your way back again. It was also the only time that bank robbers like our own Ned Kelly could make their escape from banks. So darkness has its merits and soft light has its uses. Now, when you came into lighting about 35 years ago, there were almost no independent lighting designers. You now say that there are 250 established practices.
That's in the UK. There were very few of us doing what we do 35 years ago. But the number of lighting professionals now within the UK has, you know, ramped up incredibly over the last few decades. And thus it is worldwide, and particularly in Australia, the story is very much the same. Whilst I think independent lighting designers were few and far between, even 10, 15 years ago, you now have a lot of, you know, good practices there. So
you're also a conservationist, aren't you? Because there are attempts to preserve lighting. I didn't realise that, for example, that around Covent Garden and many other parts of London, there's still gas lighting.
Yes, I know. It seems incredible, doesn't it, in the 21st century that there's still working gas lighting in central London, but there's actually a surprising amount of it. It tends to be sort of clustered, some near sort of the Houses of Parliament in that sort of area, quite a lot around Covent Garden, also sort of in the sort of Inner Temple, the legal area of London. There are sort of some quite extensive gas lighting schemes, and it sort of causes quite a lot of debate as to whether, in a world that's sort of grappling with climate change, whether we can afford to keep sort of lighting these areas using gas, even though it produces a very beautiful quality of light.
Berlin had huge amounts of gas lighting, and that's now been substituted for LED. But surely we could keep a bit of it around just to demonstrate historically what gas lighting was like. Okay, this is the big shift. Deep down, most lighting designers know it's a form of energy and that it should be regarded as a precious commodity. You've already mentioned, in passing, climate change.
Yes, I definitely feel that light is a very precious commodity, and We've come to take it, I think, in our society very much for granted. You know, we actually notice an absence of light rather than the presence of light. We walk into a room, we flick a switch or press a dimmer, and, you know, if there isn't any light, then we notice it, but we just expect it to be sort of on tap, quite literally. And I think we do have to begin, you know, I've been preaching for many years that we have to begin to think about it as being a precious commodity and sort of think a little bit more along the lines of less is more, to quote a famous architect, in order to move forward.
And you also point out that light can be a problem, that light pollution must be looked at. I know that's a case, that's a big problem for astronomers.
Yes, it's certainly, astronomers have always led the way in terms of complaining about light pollution, particularly in terms of their abilities to observe. But I think it's, I was going to say more important than that, all forms of pollution are a problem. But light pollution can not only cause problems for astronomers, but, you know, for people and creatures. And you alluded to that at the beginning of this piece, that, you know, artificial light is only really needed by us, by human beings, and most other creatures are adapted and well adapted to the night. And actually, the presence of light pollution and too much artificial light can cause a lot of ecological problems and problems with biodiversity.
Well, I guess obviously bats aren't too happy about it, and many birds, and of course it would also cause confusion with insects.
Yep. Bats, birds, insects, turtles, you know, the list is very long. And, you know, birds strike, particularly in tall cities, as our cities grow, particularly with glowing glass towers, you know, floor to ceiling glazing. At night, quite often migration patterns of birds can be adversely impacted. And, you know, there are a lot of problems in particularly in North American cities with what they call bird strike, where birds, you know, strike the building heading towards the light and then sort of, you know, are killed. In fact, you know, millions of birds every year are lost around the world to bird strike caused by lighting.
I'm always remiss to invade personal privacy, but I have to ask you, how do you light your own dwelling?
Well, if you talk to my family, they would tell you in a very frustrated way that you know, I do like to keep it darker than they would like. I grew up as a child in the 70s, where the you know, the winters of discontent and the miners' strikes, and so I was sort of brought up in a world where switching lighting off was, you know, very much something that was embedded within me. But and I still very habitually go around the house turning the lighting off everywhere.
Mark, you and I have that in common. I'm a really grumpy light switcher offerer. But what cities are doing well?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that a lot of cities are beginning to put strategic lighting plans into place, paying much more attention to our lit environment. As was mentioned, we recently published, or back in 2018, published a lighting strategy for the square mile in London, for the city of London, and quite a lot of other cities, particularly Scandinavian cities like Copenhagen and Malmo, and many of these cities are publishing their lighting plans, which are well developed and often have a strong environmental bias.
You've shed a lot of light on light, and forgive that terrible pun, but thank you very much, Mark Major, for coming on the program, this nocturnal program, Forever Cast in Shadow. Mark Major is from Spears Major.